Welcome to the webinar, Trademarks and Designs After Brexit. We would like to thank LexisNexis for the opportunity to give this presentation today. By way of introduction and switching straight to slide three, my name is Florian Traub. I am a partner at Pinson Mason's intellectual property team in London and head our firm's trademark and brand protection team. I am joined today by my esteemed colleague, Jill Dennis, a senior practice development lawyer in our IP team in London. Well, Brexit. Rarely has a democratic decision in this instance to withdraw from the European Union divided public opinion more. Not many expected the marriage of more than 40 years to end before the Brexit referendum. And once the divorce papers had been filed, the debate both within the UK and in the negotiations with the European Commission quickly became rather acrimonious. Once the political decision has been made to take the UK not only out of the EU, but also out of the single market, it was clear that the harmonized EU intellectual property rights, such as the EU trademark or the registered community design, could no longer apply to the UK after Brexit. Thankfully, the divorce was less contentious in this particular area, and both parties found a more or less pragmatic solution. As you can see from the agenda on slide four, we will be looking today at the situation, how trademarks and design protection worked in the EU and the UK before and after Brexit. We will be looking at the scope of trademark and design protection, what actually changed after Brexit. And we will also be looking at the ongoing practical implication for right holders. And finally, we will also be looking quickly onto the horizon. So what is out there and what is going to change going forward. Moving to slide five, I would like to make one point of clarification at the outset. When Jill and I talk about the date of Brexit in the context of trademark and designs, we actually refer to the 31st of December 2020. This date marked the end of the Brexit transition period when the European treaties ceased to be valid in the UK. Technically, though, the UK left the European Union already on the 31st January 2020. So that's just a point of clarification. So moving to slide six and going straight into the matter, I'm going to talk about trademarks before and after Brexit. Well, the trademark system in Europe is basically can be compared into different layers. So at the top, you have the European Union trademark, which is a single unitary right, which gives protection across all EU member states. Before Brexit, of course, that meant in all 28 EU member states. We'll come to that, what it means after Brexit. But on a second layer, you also had always had national trademarks in each member state, or in the case of Belgium, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands, one trademark registry layer for the Benelux trademark. That always existed both on the UK and also the European continent. And then finally, you also have an international aspect where you have the international trademark registration under the international treaty called the Madrid Protocol, where trademark holders can designate either individual EU member states or the European Union as a whole as part of an international registration. Now, Brexit occurred, and what actually is the situation after Brexit? Well, national trademarks still exist, and so do international registrations. So nothing really materially changed. We still have the domestic UK trademark, and we have the domestic national trademarks in, let's say, Germany or France. And we still have the international registrations designating, for example, the UK or the European Union. So that system remained unaffected. What really changed was the fact that, of course, the European Union trademark does no longer apply to the UK after Brexit. So almost this little puzzle, the 28th puzzle out of the EU trademark was taken out. And has ceased to have effect in the UK after Brexit, so from the 1st of January 2021. But in order to recognize that the UK was, of course, part of the EU and therefore the European Union trademark, that 28th part of the EU trademark was taken out and was cloned automatically at the end of the Brexit transition period into the UK trademark register. There was no re-examination, there was no refiling. The process was automatic simply by transfer of data from one point to the other. And on the 31st of December 2020, comparable trademarks were created. And what it actually means in numbers, it meant that about 1.5 million trademarks were cloned overnight in the UK trademark register. So what we have now is a mixture between domestic trademarks that were valid before Brexit and then all these cloned trademarks in the UK trademark register. And finally, and don't forget that, also the international registrations designating the UK and also the European Union, and the latter also by way of that cloning exercise. The filing and the priority dates for these trademarks were kept the same. So trademark holders of EU trademarks and international registrations designated in the EU, they didn't lose anything. Always, everything remained basically the same. And now moving to slide 7, we're going to look at the position for designs. Jill, over to you.
Thank you, Florian. It's quite a complex picture in relation to designs. I think it's fair to say that, you know, design protection in the UK and EU pre-Brexit was rather a complex patchwork of rights. And I think Brexit has very much added to that complexity. There's that same layering of rights that you've just described, Florian, in relation to designs too. So there are national rights, there are EU rights, and there's also that international layer as well. As Florian said, we're on slide 7 now, and this is the pre-Brexit position on design protection. And at that time, there were really 4 main design rights available. So if you wanted design protection, registered design protection across the EU, and of course, pre-Brexit, that included the UK, of course, then you could apply at that time for a registered community design. You would apply at the EU Intellectual Property Office. Alternatively, you could make an international application under the Hague Agreement designating the EU, and you would get a registered right, and that would give you 25 years worth of protection. Alternatively, or in addition, you could rely on unregistered design protection, and that would be the unregistered community design. And that right arose automatically when the design was first disclosed in the EU. That gave you 3 years of protection. And the rights very much mirrored each other. So both of the rights protected the shape of the whole or part of an article and its appearance as well. So it protected both 3D and 2D designs like surface decoration. You may be thinking, well, why two designs that are so similar? The unregistered community design is really useful when getting a registered design just, you know, isn't practical or doesn't make commercial sense. If you look at the fashion industry, for example, designs move on very, very quickly. So, you know, getting a registered design just isn't economically viable. It doesn't make sense at all. So the unregistered community design gives you that short hit of protection for the season, and then the designs will move on pretty quickly. So pre-Brexit, across the EU, you have the registered community design and or the unregistered community design covering the EU and the UK. Of course, if you wanted just national protection in the UK pre-Brexit, then there were other rights that were available to you. So you could go for the UK registered design in terms of validity and duration and the designs that it covered. That exactly mirrors the registered community design, but of course, just covering the UK. You would make your application to the UK IPO, or again, alternatively, via the international route under the Hague Agreement designating the UK. There was also the UK unregistered design. Now, we'll come on to talk about that in a little bit more detail, but in terms of the unregistered community design, it's very, very different from the UK unregistered design, and that has implications that we'll come on to talk about. And I appreciate I said 4 rights, and this is a 5th, but there was a limited amount of copyright protection for designs as well, but that's really beyond the scope of this webinar, so I'm mentioning it just for the sake of completeness, but I won't mention that again. So that was the pre-Brexit landscape. Post-Brexit, and now we're moving on to look at slide 8. So on Brexit, on the 31st of December 2020, what happened was that the community design regime just fell away from the UK. It just stopped applying here. So registered community designs and unregistered community designs stopped providing protection in the UK, but of course they continue to provide protection in the EU 27. So there was a real loss of community design protection in the UK. So the UK had to reform its designs regime to really compensate for that loss. So how was that done? Well, if we look at the design, registered design protection first, on Brexit, all of the registered community designs that were registered and published on that date were automatically cloned onto the UK's design register at the UK IPO. And those clone rights are called re-registered designs. They are equivalent to the registered community design, but of course cover only the UK. So if you're sort of a bit of a visual person, you know, really it's like the UK element of the registered community design was sort of split off. So the registered community design continues to apply to the EU, and the UK bit has been cloned into a re-registered design, effectively a UK registered design, and that now covers the UK. So you've got two rights where you previously had one. And quite importantly, as Florian highlighted for trademarks, a re-registered design retains the application, the registration, the priority date of the parent registered community design. And we'll explain the significance of that a little bit later on. And the same cloning process happened for international designs designated to the EU. So the UK bit, if you like, was cloned into a re-registered international design in the UK. Insofar as the UK registered design is concerned, that's continued as before, totally unaffected by Brexit. So that's still around, still the same, no change. The position in relation to unregistered rights is definitely a little bit more complex. Copyright protection is still around. We're not going to cover that. Similarly, the UK unregistered design is still around as well. That's unaffected. It carries on as before. What is likely to change in relation to that right is the people who will qualify for that protection automatically. And we're already seeing legislation in the UK around that. So that's likely to change, but the right itself is unaffected by Brexit. However, and here's the real nub of the issue on unregistered protection, the scope of the UK unregistered design does not mirror the unregistered community design. They're very different in terms of their validity requirements and duration and so on. Just to give you a couple of examples, the unregistered community design protects the appearance of the whole or part of an article. So it covers 3D and 2D aspects of a design, like surface decoration, for example. The UK unregistered design doesn't. It only protects the shape or configuration of an article, so just 3D designs. And similarly, to qualify for unregistered design, unregistered community design protection, the design has to be novel, it has to have individual character over previous designs, whereas the UK unregistered design need only be original in that it's not been copied, and not commonplace. So there's a real mismatch between those two designs. And that was really significant because that meant that post-Brexit, some designs that would have attracted UCD protection in the UK, surface decoration, for example, would not get protection under the UK unregistered design. So there was the potential for a real gap in protection in unregistered designs in the UK post-Brexit. So the UK recognised that, they had to compensate for that. So the way in which that was done was that two new unregistered designs were created, and they are in addition to the UK unregistered design, which just stays the same, it's still there. The two new rights are known as the continuing unregistered design and the supplementary unregistered design, and they both entirely mirror the unregistered community design in terms of validity, infringement, and so on. But of course, the two new rights only cover the UK. The continuing unregistered design makes up for unregistered community designs falling away from the UK at Brexit on the 31st of December 2020. It's in effect a clone of the unregistered community design that continues to protect that design in the UK for the remainder of its 3-year term. So that's a right that's going to disappear within the next 3 years. The supplementary unregistered design fills the UCD gap, the unregistered community design gap, in the UK for future designs. So designs that are first disclosed in the UK will be automatically protected by this right for 3 years. So it's a new right that, absent significant design reform in the UK, is going to be around for some time. So I appreciate that's a lot of information to conjure with in relation to both trademarks and designs, but I hope you found our overview of the changes that have been made helpful. We're going to move on now to talk a little bit more about the real practical significance for rights holders of those changes that we've described. And we're now moving on to slides 9 and 10 of the presentation. Florian, if I could throw out a question at you at this point. It's clear from what we've both said that lots of cloning went on at the UK IPO on the 1st of January 2021, both around trademarks and designs. Did it all go smoothly?
Well, generally, actually, considering how many trademarks and design had to be copied and cloned into the UK register. So generally speaking, yes, it was a smooth process. The UK Intellectual Property Office basically froze down their systems for a few days over the new year. And when they reopened on the 4th of January, 2021, then all these trademarks and designs magically appeared on the register. There are still bits and pieces where on individual cases, data was incorrectly copied, as you would expect, considering the number of data that went across. So we still see occasional movement, particularly when it comes to international registrations designating the EU and now the UK, where data is still corrected. So you can expect a little bit of back and forth in that. The one area where it probably didn't go as smoothly was in the area of international designs designating the EU. That data only came over into the UK Designs Register on the 25th of February 2021, so almost 2 months after the event. But the main reason for that is that the data was not as readily available because the international designs are not shown on the EU Designs Register. So they had to get the data from somewhere else. But generally, actually quite a good job.
That's great to hear, given the amount of work that was involved for the UK IPO. I'm thinking about pending applications. We've been talking about sort of existing registrations, but what happened to European Union trademarks and registered community design applications? I should say applications, both in relation to EUTMs and registered community designs. Were there applications pending for those before the EU IPO on the 31st of December 2020? What happened to those?
It's a very important point, Jill, because those pending applications were actually not copied or automatically cloned. So there's an absolute exception to that. Only registrations were affected by this cloning exercise. Any EU trademark that was pending on the date of the 31st of December 2020, or indeed an international registration hasn't been granted yet, or for designs, a design which was either pending or crucially, which was not published on the relevant date in the Designs Register, that includes designs the publication was deferred, they were not cloned. And they can be refiled if the rights holder so desires until the 30th of the September 2021. And that's a very important deadline to bear in mind if you want to obtain an equivalent registration in the UK for these rights, and you want to benefit from the same filing dates or priority dates of the EU equivalents, then you have to start that process by the 30th of September 21, and ideally probably even before, because we can obviously expect a rush to the UK register shortly before that deadline. So it is very advisable to go through your portfolio and look at that. And also, just for sake of completion, if you had pending opposition proceedings against an EU trademark, obviously they weren't registered at the time when Brexit came into being, so they need to be refiled in the UK as well.
So you've mentioned the 30th of September 2021 is that refiling deadline, and that's so that the priority date is preserved. Why is preserving the priority date important?
Well, priority dates are important because the priority date does determine the position as to when a right holder has the better superior rights vis-a-vis third parties. So just imagine, for example, you had a pending EU trademark since the 1st of October 2020, and there is a third party who then went ahead and applied for either an identical or similar trademark 2 months later or 3 months later. Then in respect of the EU, you have the better rights because obviously you filed it 2 or 3 months earlier. But in respect of the UK, unless, of course, you apply for registration in the UK by the 30th of September 21, you risk to lose that advantage, the priority date. If you file before that deadline, then your application is effectively dated back to, in my example, 1st of October 2020, and then you can trump that later filed application, and that's why it is so important.
Uh-huh. And when you refile in the UK, must your application exactly match your pending application, or can you make kind of tweaks and changes to your UK refiled application in that time?
Yeah, good question. It has to be the same application. It has to be the same applicant. It has to be the same trademark, and it has to at least include the same goods and services as applied for the EU trademark. And that's basically the same as with claiming priority under the Paris Convention, which is the normal way of claiming priority. And by the way, that is still open to any UK applicant. So you can still use the Paris Convention to claim priority of earlier filed trademarks and designs. So now we're looking at the scope of trademarks and design protection, whether this has changed after Brexit. And Jill, you talked about designs earlier in quite some detail. So what are the actual changes now? Is the scope still the same?
It is still the same. That's with one caveat, which I'll explain. But yes, the scope of design protection post-Brexit is exactly the same as pre-Brexit. It's just the configuration of existing rights that you need and how you go about getting new rights that's changed. So if I just explain that perhaps in a little bit more detail. In terms of your existing rights that existed on Brexit, so your registered community designs, your unregistered community designs, they'll continue to give you protection in the EU, just as before. You will have your cloned rights, your re-registered designs, your comparable trademarks, your continuing unregistered designs. That's going to give you equivalent protection in the UK. So that the scope of protection is the same. You've just got more rights to get the same protection that you had pre-Brexit. So no real change there, just the number of rights that's changed. In terms of getting new rights, if you're wanting registered protection in the EU and UK, you're going to have to make duplicate filings, whereas previously you just had to make one. So you'd have to apply for a registered community design to the EU IPO and to the UK IPO for a UK registered design. So an administrative burden there, but entirely possible to get the same sort of protection as you had before. I should highlight one issue around unregistered design protection. There's definitely an issue to be aware of here. The unregistered community design and the supplementary unregistered design that I mentioned earlier, they may well be mutually exclusive rights going forward. They are rights that arise automatically on disclosure of the design. For the unregistered community design, it's when the design is first disclosed in the EU. And for the supplementary unregistered design, it's when the design is first disclosed in the UK. Now, of course, disclosure in one territory is going to destroy novelty in the other. So you cannot have protection in both territories, which means that going forward, designers are going to have to make some sort of commercial decision around where they want unregistered design protection, what's their primary market. And that's ultimately going to dictate where they make their first disclosure of their design. I should stress at this point that there's an awful lot of uncertainty around these issues at the moment. We're waiting for the European Court of Justice to bring us some clarity around place of first disclosure, what happens on simultaneous disclosure and that kind of thing. So very much an uncertain picture at the moment. But you know, it does make some interesting questions. You know, query, for example, an online disclosure. Let's say London Fashion Week, you know, streams live around the world online. Is that a simultaneous disclosure in the UK and EU? Does that mean that you can get both rights? Well, we thought you could only get one. Or does the fact that it's, you know, the design has been disclosed elsewhere in the world mean that novelty has been destroyed in the EU and UK for the purposes of your unregistered protection there? None of this we know at the moment. So it's making for some interesting questions for designers to have to think about. And we're very much looking forward to that European Court of Justice clarification. In light of this uncertainty, what should designers do? Well, for now, disclose in one territory to get unregistered protection there and apply for registered protection in the other. You may be thinking, well, which one? Well, for UK-based businesses, probably a good solution is to disclose your design first in the EU, get unregistered protection there, and apply for registered design protection in the UK. A couple of very practical reasons for that. It's very cheap to get registered design protection in the UK. Very, very good value indeed. At the time of recording this webinar, if you make a multiple application for 10 designs, it will cost you £70. So an absolute bargain. And it's also generally preferable for a design holder to have registered protection in their home market. So that's, you know, a possible way forward. But of course, the right way forward, it will differ for every business. So you have to make the right commercial decision for your business and your business strategy. Another alternative, of course, is to dispense entirely with unregistered protection and all the uncertainty around that and apply for registered protection in both the EU and the UK. Still relatively inexpensive and a great right to have in terms of enforcement and so on. The position on trademark protection, Florian, I'll mention that. I realise you're covering trademarks, but maybe just for completeness, the position is exactly the same for trademarks. So again, the scope of protection hasn't changed post-Brexit. It's just the same as before. It's the configuration of rights that's changed. You need more rights. And it's how you go about getting new rights that's changed. The need for duplicate filings in the UK and EU that just didn't exist before. So you've got multiple rights now and the requirement for multiple filings going forwards. If we move on to slide 11, Florian, I'm going to throw out another question at you, if I may. We've talked about this holding of more than one right now. Obviously, that's going to have some real implications for rights holders around portfolio management and that kind of thing. Renewals obviously is a significant part of that. What's the position on renewals now with this multiple rights in place?
Yeah, thanks, Jill. Well, it's basically very similar to what you said earlier about new filings. You basically have to now think about two separate systems. So renewals will be due both in the EU as well as in the UK. And just as a reminder, when it comes to EU trademarks and UK trademarks, also international registrations, renewals are due every 10 years. So that's a requirement. If you don't renew a trademark, when it becomes due for renewal, then the trademark registry will eventually just simply remove the trademark from the register and it will be cancelled. So renewal is important. It is an administrative burden and obviously also additional costs involved because now we have to renew trademarks both in the EU and the UK. And bearing in mind that you have to do that in both jurisdictions, don't just rely on the fact that you have already renewed an EU trademark and therefore you think it might be automatically renewed in the UK as well. So the relevant date for assessing whether you have to think about two renewals is the end of the Brexit transition period, this 31st of December 2020 that we mentioned a few times. Any renewal that was due before that date had to be done for the EU trademark. Any renewal that falls after that date has to be done separately for the UK as well, in addition to the EU trademark. So in the event that you duly renewed a trademark in December 2020, which was actually due for renewal in, let's say, February 2021, then you still have to separately renew the UK trademark in February 2021. because of that date that I just explained. So please bear this in mind. And I think that is a real trap for many trademark and IP holders, that they're not looking at these renewal dates in a sufficient manner. And also when it comes to the actual the relevant renewal date, it is generally the same like for the EU trademark. So again, some of the data that has been copied into the UK register, and generally also the same for international registrations, unless and there is an exception, we are dealing with a subsequent designation to the European Union under the international registration. So in the event that the right order already had international registration and then months or years later has then decided to extend that protection by way of a subsequent designation to the EU, then the relevant renewal date for the UK equivalent is not the date of the international registration, but the date of the subsequent designation. So you have to manage two different dates, and your advisors should actually manage that proactively for you. So here we are for trademarks. Please bear this in mind. I know it just sounds like an administrative burden, but it's very important indeed. And similarly to what Jill said earlier about trademark and designs, when it came to the scope of protection, same here for registered designs. We actually have the same renewal implications that I just mentioned for registered designs going forward as well. So again, you have to think about two different systems and two different renewal dates for designs. Just bearing in mind, of course, that the design renewals are due every 5 years, as opposed to the trademarks where you have renewals due every 10 years.
That kind of renewal situation is definitely a pitfall, I think, for rights holders, so definitely one to watch. I think another pitfall, potentially for rights holders, in trademark rights holders, is the need to use trademarks, of course, very specific requirement for trademarks. Could you explain for him what the use requirement is now that we've got two trademarks, the EUTM and the comparable trademark, rather than one?
Sure. So just at the outset, you should know that trademarks have to be used following a grace period during which the trademark holder is actually exempt from showing any use, which we call a grace period for non-use. And that grace period runs 5 years after registration, and that's the same position both in the EU and the UK. After that grace period, use is compulsory. And what can happen here is that a trademark holder actually is losing registered trademark protection if a third party applies to have the registration revoked for non-use, or quite commonly also in a contentious situation, either in an opposition or a cancellation action or even litigation, the defendant, so the alleged infringer, would apply or would counterclaim to have the trademark registration revoked or reduced in scope if it is not in use in relation to all the goods and services for which it has registered. So now that's the position, and that position hasn't changed. But what's the position actually in terms of two different geographies, UK, EU? So basically, the parties, so UK, EU, have found quite a pragmatic position here, solution here. But because basically the position on use was frozen on the 31st of December 2020. So the use that a trademark holder had before that date, before the 31st of December 2020 in the EU, will also count, at least initially, in the UK going forward. And the same, by the way, is also the case for reputation. So let's just look at a few practical examples to make this a little bit more tangible. So let's assume a trademark has been registered 8 years ago as an EU trademark and was in use both in the UK and in the EU. Well, position is actually relatively straightforward. Also, after Brexit, trademark can be maintained because it was in use in both jurisdictions. In my second example, you have a UK trademark holder, had an EU trademark, mainly used to trademark in the UK, but there's no real use in the EU. So in this scenario, you have a situation where the EU trademarks still accounts to be in use because the situation was frozen at end of 2020. And that former use in the UK still accounts for the EU part going forward. But following 5 years after this new grace period, the trademark in the EU, if it is not in use, then is vulnerable to cancellation for non-use. Whereas in the UK, of course, you have continuous use for the UK portion of the trademark. From the perspective of the owner of a UK trademark, the message basically is, if you want to maintain your EU trademark going forward, then you have to start using the trademark in the EU as well as in the UK. And that's basically the main message here. If the trademark was not in use in the EU before Brexit and the grace period for non-use has expired, well, then the trademark is vulnerable for cancellation for non-use in both jurisdictions, unless, of course, the trademark owner recommences that use in one of the two jurisdictions or in both. And then finally, perhaps, if the trademark was registered, let's say in 2018, so was still within that grace period for non-use that I mentioned initially, then that grace period is set to continue both in the UK and in the EU for the remainder of the term. So in my example, then the grace period expires in 2023, at which point the trademark owner has to have use in the UK and the EU in order to maintain it in both jurisdictions. And essentially the same approach and rules also apply to claiming reputation. And that's quite a pragmatic situation. Going forward, be proactive, maintain good records of using your trademarks, of the evidence of using trademarks going forward, because it makes it much more easier when it comes to defending and maintaining a trademark registration after that grace period expires.
Thanks for clarifying that, Florian. And just to clarify for viewers that the use discussion is on slide 12, and we're going to move on now to slide 13. And again, Florian, I'm going to throw another question at you. Am I right in saying that international trademark registrations, applications using the Madrid system hasn't been too much affected by Brexit, and similarly for international designs under Hague?
That's generally right, Jill, in answering your direct question. It is pretty much still the same, and the main reason is that the UK, as well as the European Union, are all members of the relevant treaties for trademarks, the Madrid Protocol, and for designs, the Hague Agreement. And therefore, applicants can still use international registration systems as before. There's one exception, though, of course, under the Madrid Protocol. In order to be entitled to file an international registration, the applicant has to have, either has to be a national of the home registration country, or has to have a permanent establishment in that very country. So again, to make it a bit more tangible, from the perspective of a UK trademark applicant, mostly, let's say, a UK company, they will use the UK trademark to file an international registration. And of course, that's not a problem because the UK company will be based in the UK. But a UK company will no longer be able to use the EU trademark as a basis of an international registration, unless, of course, the UK company has a permanent establishment in the European Union. And the position for registered designs is pretty much the same. The position for international designs is slightly different in the sense that you don't have to have a home registration, so not a national design, in order to apply for an international design. The design applicant can go directly to the World Intellectual Property Organization based in Geneva, Switzerland, and apply for international design. And of course, from a UK perspective, I might want to decide to claim both protection in the UK and the EU in other countries as required. So that's the position on international registrations. And Jay, I was going to fire a question back to you now about licenses and security interests. So they can be recorded against trademark and designs. So what happened there in the cloning process?
Well, not a lot happened in the cloning process, unfortunately, which is where we have the pitfall that it's worth, I think, as mentioning now. So, of course, let's take an example. As you say, it's possible to record licenses and security interests against registered rights, so European Union trademarks, registered designs, and so on. Let's take a license by way of example that was already recorded against a European Union trademark at the EU IPO on Brexit on the 31st of December 2020. Now, of course, that EU trademark, as Florian's indicated, was cloned in the UK into a comparable trademark. Although the license will be deemed to apply to that comparable trademark, the license itself hasn't been automatically recorded against a comparable trademark during the cloning process. So that recordal hasn't happened automatically. Does that matter? Well, yes, particularly from the point of view of a licensee. There's no requirement in law to register a license or other interest against the relevant registered mark. But certainly from a licensee's perspective, it's very advantageous to do so. There are certainly downsides of not doing that. For example, a third party who isn't aware of the license, who takes a conflicting right, won't be bound by the license, they'll take free of it. Similarly, a licensee who hasn't registered their license against the mark or the design, if there are infringement proceedings, then they won't be able to claim their costs of those proceedings. So there are some definite downsides of not recording your rights as against the registered rights that they concern. So because there's been no automatic recordal of rights in the cloning process, we've been given a 12-month grace period within which that can be done. So licensees can now approach the UK IPO and seek to register their interests against the appropriate mark or design. That 12-month grace period runs from the 1st of January 2021. So licensees, for example, have pretty much got the whole of 2021 within which to do that. And during that period, they'll be protected against any of the negative consequences of not having registered. So definitely worth them doing that. I think from the point of view of rights holders, the holders of these new comparable trademarks and re-registered designs, they should definitely inform their licensees of the existence of these new rights. So the licensees can actually make that recordal application if they wish. And indeed, they'd be well advised to do that. And just on a broader point, Florian, I think, you know, now is as good a time as any for rights holders to review their existing IP agreements and just check that they are generally fit for purpose following Brexit, you know, around the description of territory and that sort of thing. So definitely a good time to review those licenses now.
Thanks, Jill. Moving on to slide 14, I think you already indicated that, of course, the management of trademark and design portfolios become a little bit more complex. I think that's probably a fair thing to say. So what is the position on actually UK and EU representation? Are there any changes afloat?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a fair thing to say. And yes, there have been some changes around representation and address for service requirements since Brexit. Again, one of those pitfalls that rights holders can easily fall into, I think. So from the 1st of January 2021, for new applications before the UK IPO or a request to start contentious proceedings before the UK IPO, so opposition proceedings, for example, parties have needed a UK representative, really. And the reason for that is that you have to provide a UK address for service for both of those things that I've outlined. That is an address within the UK, Gibraltar, or the Channel Islands. And of course, having a UK representative, particularly if you're not, of course, a UK-based company, is absolutely the best way in which to do that. You do not need a UK address for service for managing your comparable trademarks or your re-registered designs until the 1st of January 2024. So a bit of a gap there. However, even though there is that gap, I think it's probably fair to say that appointing a UK representative for your UK portfolio in its entirety now is probably really advisable. I mean, they're going to know the sort of procedural nuances around what the UK IPO do so that they can act now to keep the management of your UK portfolio as smooth as possible, avoiding any kind of bumps in the road. I think also, again, a very practical matter, if you have an EU representative representing you before the UK IPO, they are going to receive all of the important notifications around your rights by post. And of course, we all know the downsides of postal communications. They can be delayed quite significantly. They can even get lost. And of course, if you're not acting in a timely way on those notifications, it can, in worst case scenario, actually result in loss of rights, which clearly is something you want to avoid. So communication between the UK IPO and UK representatives is arguably much, much easier and much smoother. Communication is by email, which, I know they have their day emails, but on the whole, email communication is much more efficient and works without any issue. Just for the sake of completeness, to mention that since the 1st of January 2021, you will need an address for service in the EEA to manage your EUTMs, your European Union trademarks, and your registered community design. So that's been a change as well. Sort of shifting the picture a little bit now, Florian, and we're now moving on to slide 15. I think an area that probably isn't widely understood is the impact of Brexit on contentious proceedings involving trademarks and designs. So I'm thinking proceedings before both the courts and also the registries as well. What, in particular, what happened to proceedings pending on Brexit on the 31st of December 2020? And also, if a party has the benefit of a pan-European injunction or is subject to that, what's happening in relation to those now?
Yeah, thanks, Jill. It's almost like a common thread through our presentations that basically anything that happened ongoing is going to continue, similar to the position on the registration side, whereas anything going forward is basically splitting into two systems, where you have the UK system and the EU system. But to expand that a little bit more in detail, so any pending contentious proceedings, both before the courts as well as the registry, so that's the Intellectual Property Office, which was ongoing on the 31st of December 2020, will basically just continue to completion as it was, as if the UK was still an EU member state. And that includes court proceedings that are contentious. The courts can still issue EU-wide injunctions, and they can decide basically on EU trademarks or designs as if they are still an EU court. Of course, they are just a very limited number of infringement proceedings pending at the time of Brexit. So more importantly, actually, going forward, the position will be different in the sense that, of course, the UK courts and also the UK registry, they can no longer deal with EU trademarks, and therefore UK courts in this instance, they can no longer grant any EU-wide remedies. So trademark owners, if there's an infringement that is cross-border, both in the UK and on the European continent, they have to start two separate proceedings, both in the UK and in the relevant member states of the EU in order to enforce their trademarks. But in terms of good news for change, any pan-European injunctions that were in place and issued before Brexit, they will continue to cover the UK as well as the EU as if nothing had happened, basically. So they are still valid titles to be enforced against infringements. We talked about a number of pitfalls still in our presentation, and here's another one. Obviously, we already established that all EU trademarks that were registered at the time of Brexit were automatically cloned. And that also includes trademarks that had actually a pending challenge against them by way of a cancellation action or a revocation action for non-use. So these were copied and cloned into the UK register as described earlier. But if there is a pending action against those underlying EU trademarks, so that the EU parent, as it were, and it comes to a decision in the future, even years from now, if that decision is adversely affecting the EU trademark, then that will also have an effect on the comparable trademark, which is the cloned trademark in the UK. So if the EU trademark is cancelled anytime in the future, then the comparable trademark is invalid as well. So two practical implications. First of all, that is only the case insofar the proceedings, the pending proceedings before the EU Trademark Office, the Intellectual Property Office, are only affected insofar as the UK portion of that EU trademark was affected. So if you have, for example, a revocation action for non-use, that will have effect for the UK part as well. So the comparable trademark is at risk to be revoked at a later stage. But if that cancellation action was pending on the basis, for example, of prior rights in, for example, Spain, and is successful, then the EU trademark might be cancelled, but the UK portion was not affected by that proceedings, by these proceedings, and therefore the UK comparable trademark is unaffected. And the second implication here is the UK Intellectual Property Office is not going to proactively monitor these proceedings in Europe. So basically, it means that it is left to third parties. In most instances, of course, the parties that are the parties before the pending proceedings in the EU will have to notify the UK Intellectual Property Office of such proceedings, and only then the UK IPO will take action. So it's worth thinking from a due diligence point of view going forward to check whether the underlying EU trademark is actually still validly registered or whether there are any effects on the UK portion of that trademark. So watch this space, lots of pitfalls in that area. So we're going to now come to a different part, or the last part of our presentation. We want to look ahead a little bit at what is on the horizon for trademark and designs on slides 16 and 17. And perhaps I can ask the first question to Jill to talk a little bit about designs. You already mentioned that the position on designs is relatively complex, and it might even get worse, right? Because there are ongoing changes to the EU regime. So what do you expect to happen there?
Absolutely. Hopefully the position won't get worse, but who knows? I think we can certainly expect to see divergence on the protection of designs between the UK and the EU in the not too distant future. The EU and UK trading cooperation agreements deals to some extent with the future of designs. There are some specific articles around that. And what that agreement does is really set out the bare bones of registered and unregistered design protection that each party is required to maintain in place going forwards. But it really is the bare bones. And I certainly think that within that, there's significant freedom for both the UK and the EU to amend, change, refine their design regimes going forwards. And I think the EU are going to do just that. And I think they've been looking to do just that for a very long time. The European Commission recently launched a consultation on the reform of the EU designs regime. That was launched on the 29th of April, 2021. It's difficult from that consultation in and of itself to say, well, you know, we know exactly what's going to be reformed at EU design level, because the questions asked in that consultation are very, very broad indeed. But the reform of EU designs has been an ongoing project for the European Commission for many years. So if you kind of look at that over time, take the totality of the kind of reports and mini consultations that have been carried out, I think taken together, they give us some clues around where we might see reform. And I'll just highlight, you know, one or two of those just to give you a flavour. So I think one particular challenge the European Commission definitely wants to address in relation to EU design protection is underuse of the design system. And I think as a consequence of that, we could well see a number of reforms, things like streamlined registration procedures as between different member states, perhaps even a broadening of what constitutes a registrable design beyond kind of purely visually perceptible matter that we have at the moment. There may be more freedom around the ways in which designs can be represented in design applications. And, you know, you never know, we may even get a lowering of design fees, which will obviously be really good news for designers. I think, you know, we couldn't mention reform of designs without mentioning the spare parts kind of debacle. That's been a hot potato across the EU for many, many years now. And I think the European Commission wants to tackle that. The design protection of spare parts differs from member state to member state at the moment, which makes it very difficult for businesses to kind of operate on a truly pan-European basis. The Commission wants to harmonise protection for spare parts. Having said that, the views of car manufacturers and spare parts producers are very, very entrenched. So that's going to be a real challenge for the Commission to really find some common ground there. So it'll be very interesting to see how that plays out. And I think finally, another area that designers will welcome in terms of reform. Just a few years ago now, the trademark law was reformed to allow trademark owners to rely on their rights to prevent trademark goods transiting through the EU. Even if they weren't going to be put on the market in the EU, trademark owners could rely on their trademark rights and stop them even passing through the EU. So really strengthening the rights available to trademark holders. That is not mirrored in terms of design rights at the moment, but there is pressure for that to be aligned. So we're likely to see alignment in relation to transiting of goods through the EU as well. So a real strengthening of design rights holders' position in relation to those particular goods. Having said all of that, it's all speculation at this stage. As I say, very broad questions the commissioning are consulting on. The consultation closes on the 22nd of July 2021, and we're not expected to see concrete legislative proposals from the Commission until the second quarter of 2022. So it's a real watch this space. Don't know what's going to happen, but I'm pretty certain that we're going to see some reform at EU level. And looking at reform from a UK perspective, I mean, as you said, Florian, you know, that the UK position on designs is a bit of a mess at the moment, particularly around the unregistered protection. So now that the UK has left the EU and has that reform freedom, it's likely that we're going to see some reform at UK level too, particularly in the unregistered design protection arena, perhaps around the very contentious UK unregistered design, which has always been regarded as a slightly unsatisfactory right. So plenty to come, I think. Definitely a watch the space. And if we move on to slide 18, Florian, perhaps I could ask you, are we expecting to see significant change in relation to trademarks in the future?
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Perhaps the first thing to mention in that context is, of course, the aspect that you just mentioned at the end of the section on designs, is that the UK is no longer part of the European Union and therefore has the freedom to set their own laws, also in the area of trademarks. And we don't actually expect any major changes on trademarks. But of course, what we should bear in mind is that case law might diverge over time. So all the body of the case law from the European courts were retained in UK law by way of copying basically the EU law into the UK statute book. But of course, going forward, UK courts might diverge from that and set their own interpretation of existing laws. So there will be an interesting aspect of seeing over time changes or differences between the UK system and the EU system. But one particular area where we can also perhaps expect legislative changes is in the area of parallel trade. And more specifically around exhaustion of rights. And that is quite a sort of niche area, but is tremendously important. When it comes to exhaustion of rights, that basically affects how trademark or IP holders can control the flow of the goods, genuine goods in many instances, that were placed onto the market in a different country and then exported, imported to different countries. So for example, if we have a product bearing a particular trademark that was brought to the market and placed on the market in Germany, then basically any trader can buy these goods and then export it to another EU country, and the rights are exhausted. So the EU trademark owner cannot prevent that from being exported to another EU country, subject to very limited exceptions on that basic rule. And so what's the position after Brexit? So interestingly, the position is still the same when it comes to the exhaustion rules for goods placed in the EEA and then exported into the UK. Because the UK has adopted an asymmetrical position after Brexit, whereas the goods coming from the EEA into the UK have the exhaustion rules applied that actually existed before Brexit. So any IP rights in the trademark or designs can be exhausted if the goods were placed onto the market with the consent of the right owner. But the other way around, if goods are placed first in the UK onto the market and then exported into the EU, from a European perspective, the rights are not exhausted, meaning that the IP rights holder can prevent these goods from becoming imported into the EEA. So the flow of goods is free in one way and not so free in the other way. And exporters would need the consent of the IP holder. So the question is, what are we going to do with that position? And the UK government has announced that they are looking into this particular area. They have started a consultation on these very points, which is set to close on the 31st of August 2021. And they say that they are going into that discussion with an open eye, with an open mind. So it's quite difficult to predict whether we're going to see this asymmetrical system to continue or whether we are going to move to an international regime or a mixed regime. So watch this space. But as I said, it could have really tremendous effects on how goods flow freely between the UK and the EU and vice versa. So that would be quite interesting. And of course, one area that is of particular interest in that respect are pharmaceutical goods and pharmaceutical products, for which parallel trade is quite an important aspect and an industry in itself. Well, I'm taking a breath here because I think we have come to the end of our presentation, really. We could only cover really a few aspects of trademark and designs before and after Brexit and the practical implications for rights holders, but we hope it gave you a flavour of what the issues are, what the potential pitfalls are. But by looking at slide 19, there are our contact details. So indeed, if you have any questions around trademark and designs after Brexit, then please do not hesitate to get in touch, send us an email, and we will be delighted to help. And it just remains me to say, also in Jill's name, thank you for joining us today, and have a great day.